and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are moving swiftly on in association with oldfootballshirts.com. So then, the week started so well with us easing past Sheffield United in the FA Cup to secure a spot in the fifth round and a trip to Wolves. However, on Tuesday, we had a night to forget as we were humbled 4-0 at Luton in a game where we found ourselves 2 down after 2 minutes and we never really got going. But you know what? It happens. It's how you react. That's all that matters. And if it was happening every week, that would be a cause for concern. We move on. And what better game to put things right than a home game against your deadly rivals? That's right, it's Palace on Saturday, and it's time to get back to winning ways. We'll have to do it, though, without Simon Adingra, whose Ivory Coast team made it past Senegal on penalties, and they now face Yves Bissouma's Mali in the AFCON quarterfinals on Saturday. Karim Mutombo will also be missing, but he got his first minutes in the Asia Cup, coming on as a 67th-minute substitute in Japan's 3-1 victory over Bahrain. So joining me today as we look back over the last week and forward to the weekend is, of course, Alan Wares, and we are delighted to welcome back not only to the show, but to the country, Tom Hylands. Welcome back, Tom. How are you feeling?
I'm all right today. It's you know, process what happened Tuesday and getting over that now. So
this is group therapy. We're going to link hands. We're going to talk about our mothers. It's all going to be good.
You're scaring me now, Adrian. I don't think it's that bad. Listen, you and I say, we've said this on the show many times, you and I, we go back 45 years of Albion fandom. Tom probably goes back a couple of decades as well. These things happen. You have to be stoical about it because, frankly, you've got no choice. You can, if you are still pre-puberty, have a meltdown on social media for people who, and I have seen this, that any manager who wants to be judged should only ever be judged on their most recent game. An attitude that makes my head spin, frankly. So, yeah. Absolutely. Listen, in the first, I thought that, you know, for the Luton game that we're talking about, and we're recording this on Wednesday, I thought that we were still in it after the first 19 seconds. And apart from that, it was terrible. We were at the end, and at the end, frankly, we were lucky to get nil. But that's the way the cookie crumbles. If you play bad, you get beaten.
I responded to quite a few people, obviously mainly Manchester United fans, getting into my
really
my messages, having a little chuckle. My dad being one, and my response was, well, you know, we've always got that game in our locker. We know that it happens every so often, and you just have to kind of laugh when it does.
But it is. You do have to laugh about it. And the thing is, I mean, we've already lost 6-1 at Villa. We actually played quite well in that game. This one, we did not play well at all. We just did not turn up.
I think that's what makes this one different, actually, is because, like I say, there was the Everton 5-1. West Ham did a number on us at the beginning of the season. Villa and so on. But this one was kind of a poor performance rather than just you know, playing well and just being undone by moments of skill and moments of, you know,
balls over the top.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, the Luton, it's not as though in those other games that the other team were sort of market Villa probably, but it's not as though the other teams were markedly better. But then a game is only ever to be judged on the number of goals that are scored. Everything else, frankly, is a footnote. And I'm looking at the Ipswich versus Maidstone game, you know, 38 shots on target versus 2. It counts for nothing if 37 of those shots are missed.
Yeah, Tom.
I mean, I was trying to rack my brain as to the last time I kind of felt like that in the stands where you just knew, you know, everything's going wrong. There's nothing that can be done about it. And I think the only time that I can really recall that in semi-recent history was our last visit to Upton Park.
The 6-1, 6-1, 6-0?
Yeah, and 3-0.
Vast Tate and Patrick. I'm still haunted by that. But I ripped my favourite jacket on the way out as well, and I'm still haunted by that as well.
But the similarities are there between that game, you know, not only the early goals, but just everything we tried didn't come off. You know, mistakes at the back compounded by just players that were always going to put it in the net. And it's a demonstration of, in the Premier League, you can't make mistakes. And if you make 50 mistakes in a game, I mean, we're frankly lucky to only concede four.
Now, Tom, before the game, though, I mean, Luton brought out Tom Lockyer before the game, and it'd be fair to say that the Luton faithful and the players were delighted to see him back out and about.
Yeah, I think you could see that Luton as a team, they were fired up at the start. They were 5 yards quicker than our players, playing with much more passion, much more emotion. They were everything that we weren't. And, you know, when someone goes through such a horrific kind of thing as Tom Lockyer did on the pitch, I think that seeing him well is not only great for the Luton fans, it's great for everyone in football. But you want to go out and do your best for your club captain. And I think we were on the receiving end of that impact. And frankly, I think Luton would have beaten pretty much any team that was out in front of them last night. They were just on it.
Oh, the lift that the whole community would have had on the back of Tom's reappearance would have been huge. I mean, it's interesting you say, you know, they had more energy, more passion, but they also had a lot more drive, a lot more skill, a lot more nous, a bit more flair. I mean, we were still able to do a lot of our passing moves until we got to the final third, and then it all just petered out, something horrific. So we were still able to play our certain way. And I think that even on 2-0, Luton fans were a little bit concerned. Until such time as they got the third goal, then they could relax and, well, effectively start their party. But, I mean, it's going to go down as one of the great nights for Luton. And it's not because they've beaten the mighty Brighton and Hove Albion. It's not that at all. It's actually to do with the fact that, A, one of their own has returned. Two, they have truly arrived in the Premier League now. And we know exactly how that feels when we had the results that we did in our first season that gave our team a boost. So we, you know, from last night, we know exactly how they're feeling.
Yeah, Tom?
Yeah, 100% agree with that. And I also think, though, to your point, we still approached it the same way. And De Zerbi, again, not frightened to make changes to the formation, to the personnel. You know, Buonanotte, probably his worst game in the stripes. Just nothing that he tried went right, not for one to try him. But then the substitutions, they couldn't get into the game because of the pressure Luton were putting us under, because of that environment and just the way the game was going. No matter what we tried, it just didn't work.
Can I just point out, actually, can I add a caveat to that? Yeah, what Buonanotte was trying wasn't coming off. But there is one thing I would say. I felt they targeted him and they took turns to foul him, probably more so than anyone else.
Yeah, it was a possible red card offence on him, but
that was a borderline. If it's one of those that if it's a yellow, VAR won't change it. If it's a red, VAR won't change it, because neither would have been clear and obvious errors. I think either would have been acceptable, and he went in a bit brutally, and then and like I say, then they started taking turns on him, and that's actually for me, and I can't believe that it actually wasn't an accident or a happenstance. For me, that actually says a lot about Facundo Buonanotte's progression. Yeah, he had a poor game last night, but for me, to a large extent,
everyone
picked out of it. But his progression has been really, really good. And, you know, obviously after the Sheffield United game, which obviously we'll talk about later, you know, yeah, De Zerbi always, any time that a player scores a worldie or any time a player has a brilliant game, De Zerbi will always say, yes, and I want more from him. Absolutely. But Buonanotte is finally progressing, having done, incidentally, the transition from an 18-year-old who came over from Argentina and not going out on loan, going straight into the Premier League. And of course, you know, taking a little bit of time to settle in, being played out of position. Now he's in his favourite position that you've often talked about, Eddie, much more centrally. I think that he you can see him. You know, if he's on the trajectory he's on, he could be sort of a really good player for us.
I agree completely, and I think part of it last night was he was having to drift out to the wing a lot more. So he wasn't playing that standard 10 role where he's really, really flourished in the last couple of months. And, you know, that's just a consequence of where we're at in the season and the injuries and having to rotate the personnel. And it's just really, really unfortunate. One game doesn't make a bad player out of him. One game doesn't change our season or where we're at. We've still got so much to kind of play for and look forward to.
Exactly.
Now, if you're going to have a stinker, then have one collectively.
Yeah. I mean, Deserby called it a blackout. Dunk said we got what we deserved. And I mean, that's what we can just say is hands up, credit to Luton, outplayed, outbought, outrun, and we move on.
But it's like you said in the intro, AD, the real test is how we respond to it. If you see a lacklustre performance, and let's face it, games against Palace, they tend to bottle it quite a bit, the Albion do, in recent years. Games against Palace have not...
I was wondering who's going to get their equaliser in first.
Well, quite. It's... do you know what? Of all things... I mean, one, Brighton against Palace is a fixture I hate anyway. But even though Palace are not my most hated team. But two, it's actually, for me, come at the wrong time. To go into the Palace game... after a 4-0 drubbing, I am concerned about how their heads are dropping. But of course, I think this is the whole thing about either, as you call it, living in a bubble or living outside the bubble or whatever it might be. We as fans collectively and individually have our attitudes to how a game went. Oh my God, we were so poor. How come we've turned so bad? How are we going to pick ourselves up? And of course, this lot are professionals and they've turned in some amazing performances. Yeah. They know how to do it. The fact they didn't against Luton is neither here nor there.
Absolutely no concerns about these players lifting themselves up again. I mean,
absolutely.
I mean, you know, the likes of Lallana and Milner and Dunk will not let that happen. They'll discuss this. They'll work out what's gone wrong and they'll work out how to put it right.
And the best thing possible is that Palace aren't in the relegation zone because our record against teams in the relegation zone is horrible. So let's look at it as we've lost to Luton, similar to Everton last year, which helped get Leeds relegated. You know, losing to Luton might just help our friends up north of the three.
And perhaps the biggest concern about the Luton game was the fact that we lost another two players, possibly with James Milner limping out after 20 minutes, Pedro coming out of it looking with a nasty injury.
Well, Pedro has had to work recently so hard. I mean, he's put in several 90-minute shifts working so hard. And this is where... And again, we have to be careful. Buonanotti's 19... Ferguson's 19, but I think that possibly we could do with a bit more support from the other forwards. I mean, you know that Pedro and Ferguson and Welbeck are all different kinds of strikers, and they could and should maybe sort of mould and gel a little bit better, but I can't help feeling that at the moment as well, Pedro's doing an awful lot of the heavy lifting.
Okay, well, we'll come on to that a little bit later on. But first, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. The show is brought to you as ever in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com, an online gallery of over 130,000 football shirts of every colour and shade.
And has given us
a delightful little number for today. Tom, what do you make of it?
Horrible.
I hear Al saying horrible. I mean, it's very 90s is my first it's a lotto shirt, blue and white stripes with some crazy zigzag kind of retro lines on the side.
Well, it's the lotto logo, isn't it? Those black bits. Yeah.
And then sponsor in the middle called Saputo with red, white and green in there. The badge is quite interesting as well. The badge feels like it's a modern club because it has a football on the crest. Mm. So you need to be reminded that it is a football team.
True.
A bit like us last night then.
Well, no, there was no remnant of a football team on the pitch last night. So yeah, I'm at a bit of a loss on this one. My instinct kind of says European, just with the design and Lotto and the sponsor. Yeah. Frankly, no idea on
it. Does look very, very Italian, doesn't it?
I was about
it?
To say, the red badge looks great.
Very, very, like, I thought, is this a Juventus away kit with a badge and stuff? It's like, it's not.
The red, white and green makes me think Italy, but also the red, white and green makes me think Hungary.
No, not that either.
Oh, God. As for the black and white striped, I mean, it is a black and white stripe kind of inverted egg shape, but also it seems to be, I know, it's like a shell there, so within the badge. I mean, whoever it is must have gone on a long flight of fancy to get this design, because I've got to be honest with you, and I'm, you know me, I'm a fussy sod. All my favorite football shirts are from the period 1968 to 72. And actually, just before you read the thing, AD, I would say this. There's someone on Facebook, I think in the Goldstein Ground group, who's posting pictures of players in their previous clubs before they came to Brighton. And some of the kits that some of those players are wearing, you know, you see Chris Catlin in a Coventry shirt or Barry Bridges in a Chelsea shirt. Those kits, irrespective of the clubs, are absolutely delicious. They're wonderful. This, on the other hand, looks like an explosion in a, I wouldn't even say a paint factory, but just one corner of it. Above and beyond that, just out of our misery.
It is. Well, Tom is right in the year. I mean, do you want to put an exact year on it, Tom?
I would have gone mid-90s, and I think Lotto probably paid more to have their logo splattered all over the shirt.
I think you're probably
Let's go
right.
96.
It's 98. So there you go. And this is what Phil has to say about this particular jersey. He says, here is your shirt of the week. And this is the 1998 home shirt of MLS side Montreal Impact. The team was formed in 1992, and for the next 10 years or so, they played in the American Professional Soccer League, the United States Soccer League, and the North American Soccer League. That's too many leagues, I'm confused now. In 2011, Major League Soccer was conceived, at which time the team was effectively disbanded and reformed as an MLS franchise for the 2012 season. The team originally played at the 13,034 capacity Complex Sportif Claude Robillard Saputo Stadium in Montreal. In 2008, they moved to the all-new soccer-specific Stade Saputo, which has a capacity of 19,619. American teams are typically rubbish at nicknames, as most of their names are stupid enough in the first place. That was Phil saying that, not me. But the use of dual language in Montreal means they go by Le Impact, which is
the Impact.
L'Impact. And they don't go for goal music at the Stade Saputo, preferring the bong of a huge bell. It's called the North Star, which was acquired by the club's Ultra Supporters Group, 1642 MTL, and it gets bonged each time the team scores, and is bonged twice at the end of the game if L'Impact have won. Honours include four Canadian championships, most recently in 2021, and the 2013 Walt Disney World Pro Soccer Classic, which is quite typical for a tournament in America. You know, it only has teams from USA and Canada entering. All-time MLS top appearance is goalie Evan Bush with 176 league games, and top goal scorer is Ignacio Piatti from Argentina, who scored 66 goals between 2014 and 19. Links to the UK include Didier Drogba, who spent a season with L'Impact in 2015-16, scoring 21 goals in 33 games. Louis Binks began his career with L'Impact. He's from Gillingham originally and played his youth career with Spurs. He joined L'Impact in 2020, at the start of the season. This season, he joined Coventry on loan. And, of course, a link to the album. In 2008, Ian Westlake joined us on loan from the Leeds. He played just 11 times, scoring twice. After a few more loans and a brief time as a Wickham player, he made the move to MLS with Montreal Impact in 2011. He returned to England in 2013 and spent two seasons with Needham Market before retiring in 2015. So thank you for that, Phil. And of course, you can see that shirt and over 130,000 others over at oldfootballshirts.com. It's always well worth a look.
Well, can I just actually point out there's a couple of things here. One, we're very, very grateful for Phil Shelley's ongoing sponsorship of the Albion Raw. He's been doing it since before he had a beard, I think. And we are very, very grateful for it. And the fact that he's a sponsor does actually remind me that Radio Reverb is a not-for-profit community radio station. We cover so many things. We've actually got now an Italian language and a Portuguese language show on there, albeit Brazilian. I've listened to them. I couldn't understand a single word. Anyway, sorry. Yes, Radio Reverb is a community radio station. It cannot and does not accept advertising, but what it does accept by way of funding is sponsorship, donations, and grants. So whilst Phil Shelley is very graciously sponsoring one of our shows, if you feel like donating now that Christmas is done and your first paycheck after Christmas has arrived, please go to radioreverb.com/donate. And if you've got a couple of quid spare, please help this brilliant community project keep going. It's been on air since 2007, unbroken. It would be lovely if you could help us carry on.
Okay, another thing that is carrying on, of course, Tom, is Cup Fever. It's tinfoil cups at the ready. We're into the fifth round where we face, Wolves.
It's been the most, FA Cup dreamy run so far, hasn't it? Stoke away, Sheffield away, and Wolves away.
We know how to go to all the hotspots, don't we? Yeah. But having said that, again, and unless it's actually one of the big six or Luton now, then we realise that actually most games are winnable. I mean, we really turned them over at the beginning of the season. Wolves did a bit of a number on us recently, but then I think that obviously what the Luton game has shown us is that whilst we've had very few league games in 2024, we've also had even fewer goals in the league.
We haven't scored this year yet.
Not in the league, but although we're absolutely cramming them in the FA Cup. So if we can carry that on, then Wolves are actually for the sword. That's another matter entirely. But these games are still winnable. And ironically, we actually have although Wolves are a bogey team and they've only ever beaten us about four times in the league compared to something ridiculous like us, we've beaten them 18 times. I mean, we are ultimately their bogey team. We have a better record up there than we do down here, whether it's the Goldstone with Dean or the Amex. So it's a winnable thing, but Tom, let's go back to the Sheffield United game again. It doesn't sort of really ring true. Given that we thrashed Middlesbrough by scoring five this time last year, that was a thrashing. This felt a bit different, didn't it?
Yeah, I think it was a strange old game, isn't it? Because 2-0 up, feel like absolutely just floating through the game, feel like could have been a couple more up, maybe should have been done. And then suddenly 3-4 minutes at the end of the game and it's 2-2. You're going in completely different complexion for the second half. But I thought, really professional that second half, came out and just did what we had to do. And I think, again, just some cracking goals in there again, and just that's what we do,
2-0 is the most dangerous scoreline, of course. Famously.
Is it?
Famously. Apparently so.
Is that a cliche?
Clinically proven by someone who probably doesn't know what they're talking about. But we had the ball in the early doors. It was Evan Ferguson's had a goal ruled out for offside. And I think, obviously, we don't normally talk about goals have been ruled out, but I mean, I think it's a goal that Evan really needed. He's not been in the greatest form at the moment. I think the way that we're playing at the moment is not really suiting him. He's missing having Adingra and having Mitoma in the team because everything's now too narrow and he's not being able to operate in that. And the way that having those wingers stretches the pitch is a lot. It makes it a lot easier for him, I think.
Can I give you an example here? And let's go back to the Wolves game, the most recent Wolves game. where, again, we had so much of the ball. It was almost one-way traffic. And you had Pedro out wide on the right. You had Hinshelwood ready to cross stuff in. Remind me, I think even possibly Lamptey came on.
With all the
artillery we had up front, the reluctance to cross the ball in, and I take, well, RDZ's point about, you know, you don't put these things in thinking you're going to, you don't go for the long ball thinking you're going to, it's a 50-50. He wants to absolutely keep the ball. But the reluctance of any of the wide players to sling the ball in was maddening. And even then, when they did get the ball into the box, the reluctance to shoot was equally maddening. And the chances and who they fell to, I mean, this instance weren't so much down to Ferguson, but I think you're absolutely right, AD. The lack of width, and this is where we can talk about the returning players in the next 2 or 3 weeks. I mean, after the Spurs game, which is on the 10th, we could be back to something approaching a full-strength squad with the exception of Solly March, not far off it. But the reluctance for the wide players to sling the ball in, and because it's a legitimate tactic, and certainly Ferguson knows how to score like that.
100% agree. I mean, what we've been lacking over the last month or so is just that speed in attack afterwards. It's much more Potter-esque at the moment, in the sense of, because we don't have those players that could get in behind with 20 yards to continue running, we're having to resort to trying to find those gaps. And when we're playing against teams that are just putting in a block and really compressing that middle ground, it's hard to break through and create anything clear, which just means we have to pass it more. So it's kind of a vicious cycle.
And teams are really, I mean, he hasn't been on the best form this season, admittedly, but teams are really scared of Karim Mutoma. It's like, they quite often they double team him, which gives space for other players, which is part of the plan, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's the same with all the wingers. You know, once they're at full speed running, players don't want to put in a tackle because, you know, they'll be booked, they'll be cautioned, they run the risk of greater things. And, you know, it's normally when they're playing a high line and you're giving our wingers so much space to go into. I mean, I'm super excited to get a Dingra back, Mutoma back. I think the key one for me, though, is Enciso, players that can unlock through the middle as well as on the wing.
Bit of gut. I mean, to be honest, I was absolutely, I mean, I was sat watching, and this is an hour and a half, 2 hours of my life, which I'm not going to get back, by the way. The Senegal Ivory Coast game.
Oh, that was a shocker.
God. I mean, you know, Senegal 1-0 up with like 4 minutes to go. I'm thinking, yes, the thing was going to be back for the weekend. And then they mossy up a flipping equaliser and go for a penalty.
And how the referee didn't give that penalty first time round, I've no idea. It was VAR.
It was a clear pen.
And that was a clear pen, absolutely.
Senegal should have had one at the other end as well. So,
but additional to what Tom was saying there, there's one other thing I would say is it's not just the individual players, it's the link-ups. And what we haven't had for a long time, it's not just Mutoma, it's not just Estupiñán, it's the pair of them together. And when they do actually sort of start the game, next game, whenever that might be, I mean, we still have to consider that they might need a little bit of time to sort of get used to what they're doing once again. But there was times, obviously, last season, and obviously at the beginning, you know, the game against Wolves up there, for instance, where Estupiñán and Mutoma between them were unplayable. And that link-up is absolutely astonishingly brilliant.
Yeah, the key thing in that, well, we mentioned this earlier, a few weeks ago, Al, the key thing in that Wolves game up there was the fact that you had Solly March and
in season,
on Enciso being absolutely on fire, and it made a huge difference.
Well, I mean, even if we get, by the time we get back to full strength, the interesting thing to look out for, bearing in mind he's, you know, Veltman's still to return, is he going to get his place back anytime soon? And so, you know, I'm seized by the whole enigma of what Hinshelwood and March together on the same wing would be like. That could be very interesting. But the issue that we're talking about, like I say, no Adingra, no March, no Mutoma, and this is where I come back to the point I was making earlier. about how much running Pedro is having to do, whether as a central player or as a wide player. Now, he's not an out-and-out winger, but he can play out wide, although you can see it clearly miffs him because obviously he wants to be in the middle scoring goals. But he's trying to play as best he can like Mitoma in order to sort of like free up that space, open up that can, get past that player, whatever it might be. And of course, with Mitoma and Adingra and March's absence, you know, with all due respect to him, James Milner is not going to be able to do that. He'll keep the ball, he'll keep things ticking over, but he's not going flying past anyone anytime soon.
It's interesting that Baker Boaty keeps making the bench, and he's had a couple of appearances that he's obviously one that we are curious about and giving him a lot of experience and trying to give him some minutes. So perhaps maybe in the absence of anyone else, it might be worth actually starting him.
We can't do the whole maybe, might do. I mean, the fella has to earn his place. I mean,
right.
There is, if Welbeck gets injured, or if Welbeck and Ferguson get injured, then there is a case for putting in Baker Boaty, just basically because we've got to run out of numbers. However, it's not a case of let's try him, let's see what happens. That's what happens at the end of a game, you know, when you've got the game comfortably sewn up. You put him on for 5 minutes for just basically for the experience. And the cameos that he's played, to be fair, he hasn't done a huge amount. I think it's all about getting used to the experience rather than, you know, going on there and, right, okay, son, we're 4-0 down, it's 5 minutes to go, go and make a name for yourself. That's not going to happen anytime soon.
Tom?
And I mean, the other thing that's going to support the strikers is those returning players. You know, since they've been injured, our goals from midfield have pretty much dried up, bar the occasional gross goal. The fact is, Mitoma, Adingra, Fati and Cizo, they will all score goals from different places. And then that just takes the pressure off everyone slightly more. It gives us a bit more confidence going forward, a bit more structure, and hopefully a bit more of that feel-good kind of vibe that we had going. So, De Zerbi's obviously having to just try things at the moment just to get us through. But once we get our squad back, hopefully he will be able to revert back to the way that he really wants to play. We could see that at Luton, how many times we're still just pumping a ball through the middle, and because that's not what we normally do, people weren't really reacting to it. And so the sooner we get players back, the sooner we can get back to our structure, really.
But doesn't it say something about the team, about the squad, about the club at the moment, that here we are, complaining. I mean, you've just named half a team there, Tom, plus a couple of other defenders that have been out as well. And yet, we are having our second, in terms of position, our second best season in the history of the club. I mean, go figure. You know, we've had it before whereby, there's the stat, we've only won three of the last 16 games. But of those 16, how many have we lost? And it's not that many. We've just drawn.
No, there's been a lot of draws, and that's the thing that gets missed. But I mean, obviously,
well, of course. No. But my point is that here we are complaining, and like, other clubs have got injury issues as well. But ours is, you know, what I'm saying here is that the strength in depth of our squad, and bearing in mind that the second strength is, you know, a fair amount of kids, how key the system is, but two, how much those kids have had to step up, mature as footballers at the age of 19, and still manage to, all right, last night against Luton, hopefully was an anomaly, but here we are, still in eighth place, still chasing a Europa League spot for next season. You know,
well, we could actually be chasing a Champions League spot, you know,
with the Europa League. Too far ahead of us.
That's not maybe too far. But we said even getting into Europe wasn't going to happen. We poo pooed that idea, and look where we are.
We've still got a double one.
Yeah,
I know. Yeah, I mean it's.
I'm kind of hoping that doesn't happen, because then that will have the Liverpool fans crowing even more than they are at the moment.
Yeah, so we've still got three possible routes into Europe next season, and we're saying end of January, and yet. And this is on the back of a chastening 4-0 defeat at Luton, and yet, wow. I mean, it does beg a belief on a certain level, because I guess that probably last season we were a little bit spoiled, and this season we've tried to retain it and have had basically a lot of the season with one arm tied behind our backs. And yet, here we are still doing so well.
With success comes expectation, and that's pretty much where there's a lot of it. The expectation levels have risen with a few people. I mean,
but not
with everyone. A lot of people, we've got to be realistic and keep our feet on the ground. No one has any divine rights to success, and the fact that we're doing all right, and the fact we're having a good season is brilliant. And long may that continue.
In that case, Adi, let me take you back to the beginning of the season. I don't think we had this specific conversation, but when we were talking about who's going to be the leading scorer, how many this, who's going to be that, I don't think any of us particularly questioned about what was the season we were going to have. I mean, obviously a whole load of things get in the way, but did anyone actually think that we were going to repeat last season? I mean, did you, honestly?
I had a feeling that we wouldn't go backwards, but I wasn't convinced we were going to go totally forwards. So the fact that we've done well to get to the last 16, winning our group in Europa League, I mean, I kind of thought that the Europa League was first and foremost in everyone you spoke to. Everyone was so excited because it was a competition we've never been in before. It's something that we're all desperate to experience, you know, traveling across Europe to see Brighton, Hove Albion in these famous stadiums, in Ajax, in Athens, in Marseille. You know, this was the excitement. I had a feeling that maybe the league was being slightly overlooked in the supporters' eyes, anyway. Not necessarily, obviously, that from De Zerbi and the players, they wanted to compete on all fronts. But I just think that we are been blinded by the Europa League's success a little bit, and people want more of it, and we're hungry for more of it, and hopefully we'll get it. But we've got no God-given right to have that.
No. But Tom, I mean, if I can take you back to August, I mean, how did you feel? Let's take away the Europa League. I mean, I think AD's point he's saying is that Europa League could have actually got under the feet of the Premier League and could have been a bit too much of a distraction. I think the challenge thrown down to RTZ was to maintain the status quo of being able to put out decent Premier League sides. But did you actually think that we could actually retain the Premier League status that we've got so far?
I thought we were going to win the quadruple. No. I at the start of the season, knowing the number of fixtures we're going to have to play and the challenges with that, I think I said I'd have been happy with a top half finish, do well in the cup competitions, and do well in the Europa League. In terms of kind of where I thought we could finish, did think that, you know, if things go completely right, we could have pushed on and challenged for that top four, but with no team can at our level can manage the amount of injuries that two key players as well, and that's the point. You can have lots of injuries, but when it's taken out key players in your system, that's when it hits.
Yeah,
but De Zerbi said in an interview the other day that the target was top 10. So
that's always going to be the target because you've got to be top 10 to establish yourself, and that's a 5-year plan.
Yeah. I see this as a consolidation season. Now, it sounds a daft thing to say. I know I've said it on the show before. But there's no way that we can actually think, well, okay, we finished seventh last year. This year, club of our size, still bottom six in terms of resources. We're going to finish fifth. We're going to get to the semi-finals of Europa League. We're going to get to the semi-finals of the other two cups. Now, we got bundled out of the League Cup very, very quickly. But, you know, we're still in the FA Cup. And it's far from impossible. You know, we're still in a good sort of on the shoulder type position to challenge for a European place through the league, especially as you're pointing out, Tom, with the ridiculous amount of injuries. So, but to actually think that we could actually the bigger leap that we made from the previous season to last season, we were not going to be able to make it from last season to this season, Tom.
The thing is, we actually weren't in too dissimilar a place as we are right now this time last year. You know, we were hovering around 8th, 9th. I think the feeling was slightly different because we had kicked on and we had our difficult spell in that September, October time before the Chelsea game. So we had started that. But it's not beyond the realms of possibility that once our players are back, we do kick on. As we said earlier, it's that momentary feeling just of the last game or the last few games that gives you that. But at some point, that's got to turn in the league.
So in that case, and it's a hypothetical, and obviously depends on how the rest of the season goes, it could be seen that Pedro's 88th minute win against Marseille could have been the most important goal of the season on account of the fact that it meant we weren't playing in Europa League in February. We weren't going to, you know, we'd be playing it in March, by which time, as you say, those players who had hitherto been injured were now back, which gave us that breathing space, that extra month or the extra 3 weeks, whatever it was.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a hypothetical.
And the good news is we haven't had to play that many games in January either. So, I mean, January is games-wise is now done.
We haven't got that many in February. We haven't got that many in February, I don't think.
There's a few.
March is brutal, though.
March is going to be horrific.
March is always brutal. Do you remember that the eight when we got promoted from League One? We had eight games and we won them all 1-0, pretty much.
That beautiful 1-0 at Dagenham and Red Bridge.
Oh, my God. Okay. Well, let's just rewind a little bit back to our trip to Bramall Lane on Saturday. And one player that isn't a winger is Facu Bolognate, and he scored the goal of the round, Tom.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I think talking about the finish has been done to death, but the build-up, you know, what, 23, 24 passes, you know, that's a Brighton goal. That was
nice.
What we do.
I've just been watching it again this evening. I was just
I've only seen the highlights where they show the last or the last six, and those passes themselves were wonderful in their own right. Although there's too many replay items that only show Ferguson's nominal assist. But yeah, and if that's what De Zerbi wants out of Buonanotti, then, you know, crack on, son. Because, you know, and if Buonanotti and Enciso, when he comes back, are going to have a goal of the season competition, you know, knock yourselves out, boys.
And let's be fair, it's what we've been crying out for, people to have a little punt at goal from outside the box rather than just trying to play another five or six. But you've got to do it at the right
time. Yeah, lads, you see those white sticks? Kick it between them.
Well, if you remember last season, our goal of the season, the Albion goal of the season competition, I mean, obviously...
Went to the last game of the season.
Well, obviously, in Enciso's against City was always going to sort of do well, but you had his against Chelsea, you had all sorts. And then you have, you know, in August, Mitoma running through the Wolves defence, which incidentally still could be goal of the season for this season because it was goal of the month on Match of the Day at the time. So, I mean, if they
he's not going to win it.
I think he is so far.
This season, not just the Albion, it's going to be the... can't remember the guy's name now. Garnaccio, Man United against Everton, the overhead kick, spectacular.
Oh, maybe. Well, in that case, I think unless something else spectacular happens, Mitoma's against Wolves is going to win it, I think.
Yeah.
You know, that's where we're at now. But anyway, sorry. Yes, it was an absolute beauty. That's what we want from him. That's what happens when you put a talent like that in the middle of the park. And when it comes to the whole showreels thing that we all get to see when, we're signing another wonder kid from South America. You see the showreels, a little showboating, a little bit of this, a little dribble there. You can throw in a sort of a really good dribble that he had against City in that particular game we were talking about just now, AD. That's what you want from him. And like I say, it's kind of funny that any time that one of our players does something so spectacular, one of the kids does something so spectacular, the first thing De Zerbi says is, yeah, great, but I want more from him.
Yeah. So
I just like the thing around the kind of showreel and thinking around kind of Valentin Barco coming in, very similar with some of the stuff coming out of of the South American Olympic qualification. And I was just thinking, you know, do other clubs get bored of seeing Brighton sign X player from South America? No one's really heard of him. The jokes are we'll sell him for 100 million in a few years. But personally, I'll never get bored of it. I think it's crazy.
Absolutely. Someone else will
talk about it. That's already started, actually, when we signed him.
Bloody hell.
Well, let's face it. When we talk about selling them, let's call this for what it is. We're selling them to Chelsea because no one else is going to cough up that sort of money. I mean, you know, because Chelsea, yeah, top bottom.
They don't want to go to Chelsea anymore. Even Moyes is sad that he went to Chelsea. His agent isn't, but...
At what point does Todd Burley become our main funding source rather than Tony Bloom?
Well, I can't help feeling that he's certainly funding the fan zone out there, you know, what was it, the box park outside the stadium, which hopefully will get built in the summer.
I've said it before and I'll say it again. Have you ever seen Todd Bowley and Cartman from South Park in the same room at the same time? I don't think so.
Yeah. You will respect my authority. I won't get there, no.
That's actually pretty good, actually. It's way better than mine, so well done. No, that's their problem. But yes, I have seen a couple of glimpses of Barco during that Olympic qualifying tournament, and he looks like he's having some fun there. I mean, we're talking dancing through defences. He hit an absolute scream of a shot. The keeper got something to it, but he's going to be a funny one. Like I say, nominally a left back, but most likely a left-sided midfielder
in the middle.
Yeah, it's I guess that probably until such time as he comes to this country, and again a bit like Buonanotti, you've got to obviously give him time to settle in. You know, here if he's going to get to us for mid-February, is he going to go out on loan? It might be a bit too late by then. I'm not sure. In which case, you know, you settle him in bit by bit. I think that what you've got this time around is, although there were South American kids when Buonanotti arrived, none were Argentinian. I mean, McAllister was a little bit older. But now you've got Buonanotti there, I think it will help Barco. And I'd like to think, therefore, that Barco might actually settle in a little bit quicker because he's got one of his mates with him.
Well, this is a thing I've said it on the show before, Tom, and it's well known to regular listeners my love in with Alexis, but the importance of Alexis with these players was so important, and the fact that he helped and he was a shoulder and with everybody, it was absolutely wonderful.
But, you know, that just goes down to some that are slightly younger. You're in Cizos, you're Buonanotte's. I also, I suppose it's more hope than thought, is if Barco plays a slightly more advanced position and out on the wing where he can go and have fun, you know, hopefully that's slightly easier to adjust to as well, rather than Buonanotte playing in the middle of the park where there's so much more kind of direct pressure on you. So... you know, you can look at the likes of Adingra. I know he played in Europe, but he just came in and straight away was there. So, you know, hopefully he's in that camp and not needing the summer to be able to settle.
Well, no, obviously, the game at Bramall Lane was in, you know, it was five goals, and goals are obviously important, but so are saves. And there was a fabulous one from Bart Verbruggen in this one. Not quite sure how he managed to get there. I mean, you know the one I'm talking about, Tom.
Oh, like, that's probably one of the best saves the Brighton goalkeepers made in the Premier League era for us, I think. Just absolutely incredible save. It's one of those where it's only when you see a slow-mo replay that you go, he got something on that. Absolutely phenomenal. And again, what, he's 20? 21?
Yeah.
Like, incredible to think that he's got years before he's deemed to be in his prime. So it's exciting again.
Do you think he'll start at the weekend, Tom?
I think he has to be honest. There's two thoughts. You either keep Steele in to kind of prove that it's a one-off and that fans will be a bit upset about that, or some fans will. But, you know, Steele's been solid for us generally, and one bad game doesn't make him the worst. I think I saw someone say the worst player they've ever seen play for the Albion, which is
they can't have been supporting it for very long. I thought
they don't remember the Graham Smith days.
No, Wayne Henderson at Bournemouth, Andy Pettersson.
We've had them, haven't we? But I think we've got to look at transitioning towards him being number one properly at some point. He needs to be more consistent, especially with the ball at his feet. He's our future, isn't he?
I mean, one thing I would notice about the sort of difference between Steele and Verbruggen at the moment is any mistakes that have come from the keeper, and obviously there's that that sort of come and get the ball kind of thing and teasing them, is that Steele hasn't made a mistake with that yet. He hasn't been closed down in that sense. Any pass or any shortish pass, and when I say that, I mean the 10, 15 yards ones across the area, it's a completed pass. The ones that he hasn't completed are the ones further upfield, and that's sometimes where the player who's receiving it has been on their heels a bit, and they've lost out. The other thing I would say is that once upon a time, and I say once upon a time, let's call it for what was the beginning of last season. In fact, even probably just straight after De Zerbi came in, or Steele himself came in, was those passes down the middle of the park. Like, for instance, when Mitoma just sort of ran onto the ball against Brentford and then chipped the keeper. He was also really good at effectively being a quarterback. And I've noticed it. It certainly happened against Luton. It certainly happened against Wolves. His passes, his long passes, were going horrifically astray. It wasn't even a case of the forward not winning it. It was going to nowhere near one of our forwards, Tom.
Yeah, 100% on that. And, you know, Verbruggen, you've got to remember he is very young. He's going to make mistakes, especially when applied pressure that you get at Premier League level. And the fact that he's made a couple of mistakes, teams are going to target that. But alongside Steele, he can learn from that when Steele's at his best with the passing, and he's only going to get better. I think that generally speaking, they're both pretty good with their feet. It just comes down to decision making, and I think Steele has the edge because he's done it for a lot longer.
Well, there's that, and also I think there's also the fact that Palace's goal up there in the game at Selhurst Park came initially from Verbruggen being panicked into a clearance.
Yeah.
It depends. Do these things weigh on a particular player's mind? One doesn't know. I mean, one thing is not going to change is De Zerbi changing that attitude and that method, because, like I say, is now what, 60 games he's been in charge, De Zerbi, 70 games maybe? How many passes do we put in? 500 a game, something like that, of which the keeper must do at least 60. So 70 times 60, that's 4,200 passes from a goalkeeper, and we've nosed it up about four times.
Well, perhaps that game at Selhurst, he just wasn't quite in the mood. And it appears neither is De Hood.
That's terrible. And in fact, next time I see you, Adrian, you're going to get beers in for the entire West End Upper. That is terrible.
But yeah, it does appear, Tom, that Mahmoud De Hood could be on his way out this window. Obviously, at the time of recording on Wednesday night, the window closes Thursday. It's a weird one because we don't often get these transfers wrong. And it just appears that he's fallen out with De Zerbi. He's not even been on the bench. He's not been playing. It looks like he could be joining up with Lundav at Stuttgart.
Yeah, and you know, it is a weird one because he came in with a lot of expectation. I know it was a free transfer, but from Dortmund, people thought, you know, that's a good replacement. But it's never quite clicked. There's always been something something slightly off. And I think that red card is 100% the turning point there. I think after that, De Zerbi was quite scathing of him afterwards. And since then, there's maybe been one or two sub appearances. But he's even like not making the match day squad when we don't have enough first team players to make the match day squad. So there's clearly something between De Zerbi and De Hood, whether it's just the trust aspect or whether something else has gone on, we'll never know. But yeah, it doesn't work. Sometimes it happens, and it's best for both club and player, really.
Hang on, AD. I think getting it wrong, I think, is a little bit harsh. I mean, he clearly came with some pedigree, and playing in the midfield in Dortmund is no, you know, that's no mean feat. So, you know, we picked up some pedigree there. And there had been a couple of games where he performed pretty well, and you think, well, this is... And I remember seeing his first game, I'm thinking, well, okay, he was a little bit lightweight, a little bit rough around the edges, but it's his first time in the Premier League, he'll improve. And there was a couple of games where you think, actually, he's decent. There's something there. You can see it. But he never really pushed on. He never really progressed. He plateaued. So I think I agree with Tom completely. The red card. And you say he made a couple of sub appearances since. I thought that was his last. I could be wrong.
No, he has come back.
Okay, fine. But yeah, I mean, something's clearly happened. And like I said, we don't know if it's attitude. We don't know if there's an injury. We don't know if who knows. And at the end of the day, it's none of our business. It's their working environment, and it's for them to get on with it. But even then, even with, quote, failures, even with, quote, as you put it, AD, those that have gone wrong, it still looks like we're going to make a £10 million profit out of it. Go figure.
No, absolutely. I think that he was... you know, if it doesn't happen, there still might be a way back for him. He just needs to... I think maybe, I mean, we've seen it that Billy Gilmore came out and he said that De Zerbi was absolutely killing him in training. And like, he was coming home going, what do you want from me? What do you want from me? And it was like,
I think Van Hecker had to put up with that as well.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I suspect that the demands in training are quite harsh. And if he's not doing what the managers ask him, then that could... You know,
some players prefer the carrot. Some players prefer the stick. Some players prefer to be bellowed out in order to get their job done. Some need an arm around their shoulder. And it's the best managers, the best man managers are the ones that know which one's best. And let's face it, even someone like Sir Alex Ferguson got the best out of his Manchester United team. But there are times when his man management was absolutely abysmal. So it's a trick that, you know, even the best fall down on. And again, that's not to say it's De Zerbi's fault. We don't know what's happened. So, but if Dahoud is going to be surplus to requirements, it makes sense for him to A, go back to Germany, B, that we get a couple of quid out of it, and C, he can therefore start again. I'll say he joins Dennis Undav, but let's face it, I don't think I'm not sure that they might have played alongside each other in America, but that's about it, isn't it?
Possibly. But yeah, I've just said he's played twice since that red card. He came on as a sub in Athens, and he started the home game against Burnley.
Got you.
And was taken off at half time, I think, wasn't he?
I can tell you.
So I think, again, that was straight after his red card and, you know, played a half in the and yanked off at half time. And I think that pretty much was curtains for him.
Yeah, I think that was about it. And so, you know, listen, you know, we saw something. It wasn't to be. We wish the fella good luck, assuming he does go. And it's just, you know, have we, you know, blotted our copybook? Oh, my God, Brighton have actually signed a dub, blah, blah, blah. Well, actually, no, not necessarily, because like I say, we're going to get a few quid
the
for
signs,
it.
Yeah, the signs were there. And under a different manager, he could have possibly flourished. But it just hasn't quite worked out this
absolutely.
Time. Absolutely. So. We'll see. Like I said, the window isn't shut. Yeah, he might still be here when we're talking next week. And that is all we have actually got time for this week. Thank you so much to Tom Hyland. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been AD Packham. This has been the Albion Raw on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, on our podcast, and in association with OldFootballShirts.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you all again next week. Cheers. Bye.
In your eye, I can tell you.